I'm very pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse, Professor Martin Drum. Martin, welcome back.
It's always great to be here, Michael.
There's never a dull moment in politics, is there? If you think there's nothing to talk about, you're in trouble.
Now, there's always something new, and we're in that sort of early phase of the federal government where a lot of agenda setting is still happening. And it probably takes you a few months to really start to see ways in which policy settings will land. So you've got all the election promises and those things, but there's a lot of things in government that weren't always signposted ahead of an election.
Well, one way, if you speak too quickly, that you can get into trouble is when you say agenda setting. You could almost say gender setting. The new parliament's going to be a very interesting one to look at in terms of its gender composition, is it not?
Yeah, a lot more women. Not only that, but a lot more women in a lot more different places. So it's not just the new women are coming through the government, the party of government and the Labor Party, but also in the crossbench, in the Greens, another place in the Senate as well. And that will be a really interesting space because clearly, things like sexual assault and sexual harassment, the gap in workplace salaries, those sorts of things got a lot of attention. But a lot of those issues were largely unresolved in the last parliament. So it'll be interesting to see what solutions are found this time around.
Well, I'm sure within the government party, the Labor Party, the men are used to having to deal with the women, and they're going to have to learn that all over again with the so-called teal independents, the new independents, because they're not very happy, most of them are women, with the cut on their staff component. They've cut them back a big way, and there seems to be united, not surprising, opposition to that happening. I think Monique Ryan, who won Josh Frydenberg's seat, was one of the first to come out of the blocks and say she wasn't happy. What's going on with all of that?
There were a lot less independents in the past, and typically they had higher allocations of staff. I think there were up to 8 staff that independents could access. And as part of this cost-cutting exercise, the government says that all parliamentarians need to bear the cost of that as well, not just other parts of government, say social services. So they're cutting all staff members. I think, if I've read this correctly, that they're cutting the staff members for all members of parliament back to 4 full-time equivalent staff. That's still quite a few staff. I think if you or I had 4 personal staff to help us with legislation, diaries, travel, policy setting, constituent work, etc., that's not too bad. I think it's at state level, it's half of that. Independents do find it tougher than someone in the Labor or Liberal parties in particular, but even the Greens, because if you're in that camp, one of those camps, you've got a whole team and you're pooling resources when you're looking at policy, you're pooling resources when you're looking at legislation. The government has all the mechanisms of government, and so government MPs are just relying on that when they're scrutinising it. So I think independents do need some extra assistance when it comes to these things. But whether they actually need a heap of extra staff themselves personally, maybe one of the midway points here or compromises here is that there's a number of professional staff with significant legal expertise that are available as a small group for those independents. Just providing advice on legislation, for instance.
But
independent of government.
Yes, it'll be interesting to see whether the so-called teal independents, the new ones, decide to effectively collaborate and make up for the reduction in resources. I guess we'll find out.
I think if they're smart, they don't want to appear like a political party, so they're going to be careful there. They've got to make their own statements. They've got to take their own stances on issues. But I think at the same time, pooling some resources to understand the impact of legislation. A lot of not all the electorates are the same, but there is some consistency in in inner, some of these inner city electorates as well, which might help with the impact of legislation.
And on some of the big issues, which presumably will be coming up pretty quickly on The Voice, on the new Federal Integrity Commission, there'll be some common positions and you wouldn't need 10 or a dozen separate pieces of research advice, you wouldn't think.
No, I wouldn't think so.
Look, it's also here in Fremantle today, Martin, such a beautiful day. It reminds me of a crisp summer's day in London and wandering off to Wimbledon, which sort of gets me to thinking, are there any politicians in London at the moment or nearby who might possibly get there for a game or two?
Well, I can tell you that our Prime Minister is on the road and
likes tennis too.
Yeah, he's a long-standing tennis fan. And sometimes it's there's two ways to look at politicians attending sporting events. One is it's an utter and complete junket, and people of all sides of politics do that. The other thing that some of us would know is actually a handy networking event as well. And the before
you're a good man, Martin.
So there's you can look at it two different ways. So maybe you'll get some conversations in, but. I think really the main gig there is the get together at NATO. I think that's really important. It's not that Australia is, of course, not a member of NATO, but it's a coming together of a whole range of like-minded countries. And just like other summits, it provides an opportunity to have multiple meetings with heads of state. And there are some very significant reasons why a PM should be meeting with some of them, not least the President of France, Emmanuel Macron.
Well, we sometimes, and I must say I do, get confused about who's in the EU and who's in NATO and so on and so forth. Of course, the United States set up NATO after the Second War. They're in it. Some of the Northern European, Scandinavian states, Finland and the like, not all of them are members of the EU. And of course, there are a couple of new NATO members from amongst that group. And New Zealand and Australia have been invited along to the NATO meetings. It plainly is a very serious time in geopolitics. What are you making of it all with Ukraine in a terrible conflagration and China watching intently on the sidelines?
Now, this is an interesting juncture for NATO because if you go back 10 to 15 years, there were some people even questioning NATO's relevance. They were wondering why it still existed. It was a post-Cold War environment. Russia was doing their own thing, but wasn't seen as hostile or wasn't seen as aggressive. A lot of these countries are members of multiple forums. The European countries are very much tied together, or at least the main Western ones in the EU, you know, and economically tied together. And then you had other forums such as the G7 and the G20. Of course, with the invasion of Ukraine, suddenly NATO is very much at the fore, and the military alignment and common defence treaty that underpins NATO is now an essential piece of architecture, and you could argue probably they've never been more relevant. And the two main pieces are Russia, of course, but the other one's China. Now, China's not exactly on the doorstep of NATO, but it's very much on the US's mind and other countries as well. So suddenly NATO is back in vogue and very relevant. And lo and behold, we have a number of Scandinavian countries that want to join it. And those populations had not expressed much enthusiasm about joining NATO previously. In fact, I think the neutrality of those nations had been highly valued, you know. So it's that all of a sudden, you know, an about turn, and they see the overarching defence that NATO could provide as really, really useful. So in a way, what Russia has done is drive some of these countries into the arm of the US, to the US and Western Europe.
It's difficult for me to say this, but it looks like Donald Trump's inclination way back to force the other NATO countries to up their expenditure on defence has turned out to be a sensible policy.
Yeah, it's an interesting. I think there's plenty of people who'll be critical of Trump for a whole range of different reasons. But I would say most sort of leaders of Western democratic countries, they've probably got some strengths and some weaknesses somewhere along the line there. And in terms of Donald Trump, he did two things. He argued that the US shouldn't be the sole benefactor in military terms, and other nations should contribute and be more self-sustainable. And I think that's actually a reasonable expectation. And the second thing is, he had this sort of quirky approach to international relations, where he talked to non-traditional US allies or sometimes adversaries. Now, he had a very poor relationship with China, but he famously met with Kim Jong-un in North Korea, for instance. I have no particular warmth towards that regime and its horrible human rights record. But for the most, and I wouldn't say that we got any long-term peace accord or really tangible long-term benefits, but in the short term, it probably took some of the heat out of that confrontation, which is not itself a bad thing. Some people said it legitimised Kim Jong-un, but in a way, he didn't really need Western or US legitimisation. He didn't have that before that, didn't seem to make much difference, and his predecessors didn't have that, didn't seem to make much difference. So I think at least talking to some of your traditional enemies is not necessarily a bad thing.
No, and of course he spoke to Vladimir Putin as well, and they seem to have some sort of bromance for a while, but whether or not he was played by Putin or...
That's the open-ended question, isn't it, Michael? Was he being played by Putin? Yeah. Or was he just keeping the niceties up to avoid conflict, you know?
I tend to think the latter, to be charitable, but time will tell. Also during the week, amongst those NATO European countries, the EU, who I mentioned earlier, they came to an agreement about phasing out fossil fuel vehicles, I think by 2035, in about 12 or 13 years. Very interesting.
They're miles ahead of where other parts of the world, like Australia and the US, are, I think, when it comes to environmental policy. So I think, but there's a couple of ways in which it affects us. Firstly, if we want to do a top comprehensive trade deal with the EU, we're going to have to effectively sign up to a whole range of environmental measures. That's the first thing. And you just talked about fossil fuel cars. The UK, the EU still makes a lot of the best brands, a lot of the very influential designs in that area. So if they're moving to fossil-free cars, if they're moving entirely electric, if they're looking at other technology, that should flow on through to car makers in Asia and the US as well.
Yes, the technical way of achieving what they're doing is to require all cars to be zero carbon emissions at that point, whatever the technology is they manage to achieve it with. Well, that's going to flow, as you're intimating, into domestic politics. Before we know it, the PM, whether or not he gets to Wimbledon, he might be too busy, he might be making a visit to Ukraine, will be home again. And Parliament will be sitting towards the end of this month. Do we have a firm date yet? And what do you think is going to happen?
I believe it was the 27th of July, the last week of July, that it's sitting again. I don't have the parliamentary sitting dates in front of me, but that's about typical, the gap between the commencement of Parliament after an election in a timeframe in late May. What you will start to see when Parliament's sitting, you're going to start getting a real idea about what position the opposition takes, how acquiescent or collaborative the minor parties are towards the government and government is towards minor parties. So we get a lot of talk, but when Parliament's actually sitting, you're going to get a much better understanding of that. So the dynamics of that, there's already one extra question in question time. They're talking about giving to independents, for instance. If you ask me, Michael, I think all the questions should come from the opposition and independents. There shouldn't be any from government. But I very much doubt that my plan would be implemented. Because you're going to get a lot of attack questions from the opposition. You always do, no matter who's in opposition. But from independents, you're often getting quite a few meaty policy-related conversations coming from that. So they're less just us versus them. They're not the sycophantic ones that you get from government. They're actually more substantial typically. So let's see what happens there.
It's going to be very interesting. People who study government and the practice of government and the way accountability mechanisms work have always put a lot of store on parliamentary prime minister questions, and question time really has turned into what you were suggesting, some sort of routine. There are lots of Dorothy Dixes, and you wonder whether it's worth turning up to. I've always wondered whether it does have the same life that the Prime Minister's question time has in the UK, the English, whatever it is, Parliament, England and Wales, Westminster. Perhaps the independents will change that. They're going to have to accommodate them, aren't they?
Yeah, they are going to have to accommodate them. I just don't know if it's a false dawn, because in 2010, we had the independents that were demanding, were doing deals with government. Oakeshott, Windsor, those ones, for those of us around a bit longer, they were demanding a kinder, gentler parliament. Remember that terminology?
Yes, I do.
And we're on the cusp of something. I wondered whether this would make a difference. But that parliament went down as one of the most aggressive, combative, that was Abbott and Gillard, that was the misogyny speech, that was it was very messy. Remember the Peter Slipper debacle? It was anything but kinder and gentler in its own way.
What observation to be made, I think, at least with the benefit of some hindsight, following those two independents you mentioned and the deal they did with the government then, was that they were hated deeply by the coalition parties. And I don't know that the coalition parties can afford to approach the present crop of independents in that way. So it's still possible. We'll wait and see and talk about it for the rest of the year. What do you think in terms of legislative activity is going to be the first big things to come up in the parliament?
Well, the government has promised legislation around the Integrity Commission, and that's one big picture item. Bedding that down in a way that it has meat, that politicians are in the gun as much as public servants, that allow for some transparency around the way that they're doing that, that meets the aspirations of people in that space, including the independents who campaigned on that, the Greens who need to support it probably in the upper house, unless the Liberals did. That's going to be, I think, one of the first things to watch and one of the most interesting.
And then, of course, there's a lot of discussion about voice at the moment, the Indigenous voice to the parliament, the pressures building up for making sure this doesn't happen just by a piece of ordinary legislation, but by constitutional recognition. Is that your reading?
Yes, they definitely intend to do it via the constitution, and that requires a referendum. And there's even some flagging that they'll push on even if the opposition don't agree, which is brave and bold. But very challenging, very challenging. So you don't tend to get a referenda are challenging to push through anyway, but they're especially unlikely to be successful with opposition from the main opposition party. So I think we touched on this before, but we've seen a bit of noise in just over the last week on The Voice. Some critiques around a number of Indigenous leaders that are probably a bit more conservative in nature. And then some critiques from the Greens, who believe that treaty and truth, this concept of having a formal binding agreement between Indigenous people in Australia, and then a truth and healing commission, they believe that should come first. So they're getting some pushback from a variety of different directions on this.
Well, in the next few weeks, we'll come back to the whole question of voices as the government reveals its plans and no doubt get some others to join with us to talk about that. But in the meantime, Martin, I think we'd better get our whites on and back out onto centre court, practising our tennis before it's too late. And look forward to seeing you again next week. Thanks for being with me today.
Fantastic, Michael. Great conversation as always.